Bonjour, ni hao, comment estas? This is John James and welcome to Champagne Strategy. This is a red pill business podcast which deconstructs world-class strategy, focusing on growth, marketing, and sales with just a sprinkling of tech and champagne.
Welcome to the first episode of season 4, and I hope you had a nice break after a very strange couple of years. So today we have a cracker of an episode to start us off, and it's guaranteed to be controversial. Not that I really need much help with that, it seems, but as you know, this show is all about revealing the truth about how companies grow. So we strip away all the layers of self-promotion, conflicts of interest, and politics to expose the raw truths about how businesses work underneath. All the variables that contribute to successful growth versus those which simply don't. But as you'll know, I'm all about commercialization and growth. Successful growth and commercialization really means profit in my mind, but it doesn't in others. And this is what we're about to dive into. So today we're exploring the relationship between growth and profit. And it's often seen as two very different objectives and business playbooks. As you'll soon hear, we'll be challenging a very popular thought within the world of business, especially in the tech startup world. So be warned, if you're a founder, someone in the startup scene, investor, entrepreneur, or even someone starting a business, listening to this episode may jiggle your chain and annoy you a little bit. So listen at your own risk, because bubbles are about to be popped. Today we're talking to a professor of entrepreneurship, Per Davidson, specifically about the findings from one of his early studies, which caught my eye a few years back. And the findings from this study has recently been replicated yet again, much like some of the laws and principles from the Ehrenberg Bass Institute, which has revealed to the world these things that apply in many different contexts and have been validated multiple times. So this replicability in the world of academia is really the litmus test of something that is useful in a practical business sense, or something that's simply just another academic pushing a flimsy study seeking fame and fortune. Today, you'll find out whether you should pursue growth and sacrifice profit in the short term, or if it's better to start off profitable. But you'll learn so much more about all the contributing factors behind high-growth, successful companies as well. Regardless of the sector or type of business, there are certain fundamentals that hold true across the board. So what exactly is a high-growth firm? What's entrepreneurship? And how would you define them even to do a study in the first place? Why does it pay to have weak social ties within your business network instead of strong and close social ties? And why is a lot of orthodox business thinking in the world around growth actually not supported by empirical evidence? Which big fat lie do some investors tell founders? So without much further ado, ladies and gentlemen, this is Per Davidson. Welcome to the show. Look, I originally found out about you through, I think it was a LinkedIn post, and it was really interesting because at the time, like, I specialize in growth and it was on growth, which is probably why it appeared. And then I found out you went to the same university as me, and then it was around growth versus profit and long-term success and the difference between the two. But more importantly, you had empirical research to back this up. So just a quick second about you. You're a professor of entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I'm a professor of entrepreneurship. As you can hear, I'm not a born and bred Aussie. I'm originally from Sweden. I still have a Swedish affiliation as well. And I do research across, I mean, I've been in this game for a while, from when entrepreneurship hardly existed, and followed this field since then. And small firm growth was actually my dissertation topic back in the late 80s. Nowadays, it is not my main topic, but I've done a few big studies on my dissertation. Was one of the main things is the motivation to grow, the willingness to grow, which isn't to be taken so for granted as it is in most economic theories. I had a big project on high growth firms, which there was a lot of hype in the 90s. There's always something that is going to save us, right? Yeah. So sometimes it's startups, so sometimes it's high growth firms and unicorns and so forth, right? And it's always overhyped. So we had a big project on high growth firms as job creators, and we also sort of took a critical look at what are we really talking about, because depending on how you define or measure high growth, you end up with completely different sets of firms, and they don't tend to be in that category for very long, right? It's not a type of firm, it's a development stage rather than, and one that most firms never get into. So then an important study that I think we're going to talk about is the one about growth and profitability. That was quite important and seen as a bit controversial, and which has been massively replicated recently and so forth, and which is a great thing for a researcher that someone cares enough to replicate it. And it's one of the main problems, actually, that we come up with a lot of ideas, we come up with results from individual studies, but you can't trust results from a particular study at a particular time in a particular country. You need to have cumulative evidence before you can be really...
But just before we get to that, just so we're clear, what is entrepreneurship? Because this came up just today when I said, oh, look, real entrepreneurship is really hard. It's, you know, full accountability. It's long hours. It's not really glamorous whatsoever. A couple of crazy people sort of go and do it. Most people fail. But what's the difference between entrepreneurship and like a small solopreneur starting up and charging someone? I mean, when you're looking at these studies and we're using this term, let's just be really clear about what it is.
I mean, there is has been a lot of diversity in the literature about how it is defined implicitly or explicitly. And we had a lot of debate about this back in the 1990s. Now it is used as a somewhat loose umbrella term for the field of research and field of education. And we use more precise terms in the research. So I favor seeing entrepreneurship as the creation of new economic activities. Right? And economic is then broader than commercial. So we also have social entrepreneurship and so forth. That is, I think, a useful way of seeing it. It isn't possible to have a sharp delineation between how ambitious, how innovative, how tech-based, or anything like that, right? So it's a matter of degrees. So, I mean, a new hairdresser setting up somewhere brings something novel in that environment. It is a new choice alternative for some customers, and that is a better alternative for some. It's a more convenient, or they do a better job, or they're just nicer, or something like that. And that is, to a little degree, one of those things that entrepreneurship does, right? So it starts there, and then it goes to those that change the world fundamentally at the other end.
Okay, so is there, would you say there's different types of entrepreneurship? For example, like I just mentioned, like a small business starting out, maybe creating new product experience from an existing category, versus maybe someone in a very greenfield area like tech firms who sell this very new sort of what we call product category or use case, you know, would you sort of lump them into different groups here or not?
I mean, you have the higher ambition or high potential entrepreneurship, or sometimes it's tech-based entrepreneurship, and some want to be exclusive and only have that. I'd say that it is not possible to do, and because of the sheer numbers, the maybe less ambitious and less impressive or important by firm basis, they are also very important because there's so many of them. It adds up to massive effects on employment and so forth. So you could say a high-end, kind of more ambitious, growth-oriented entrepreneurship, more lifestyle entrepreneurship. So it's about sort of creating a job for myself and doing something I enjoy. But they also have this effect on the market, right? They stir the pot a little bit there in the market, and then you have a big category that has grown. Of course, is mission oriented entrepreneurship. You have social entrepreneurship. You have sort of community oriented entrepreneurship. You have sustainability entrepreneurship, which of course can be fully commercial, but it can also be passion mission driven. Right. So these are some broad categories.
There's two sort of, I would say, reference points that really precipitate my thinking on this discussion and why I reached out to you. Mm-hmm. One was a tweet by Nassim Taleb, the famous, you know, Black Swan author, and what do you call him, a mm-hmm. finance or economist, or, you know, sort of jack of all trades. And and the other one was a video by Chamath Palihapitiya, which is a very early product manager at Facebook. I think it was like number 9 employee or something very early, who then sort of get disgruntled almost with it, and then has gone to lead some of these SPAC rounds. He's very sort of visible with Jason Kalanakis and a few others on a very famous podcast, Silicon Valley sort of entrepreneur community. Anyway, the point is, there's this famous tweet. I'll read it out just for everyone. Until the late 1990s, a startup, in inverted commas, was something that could eventually pay off with future operating profits. Since then, a startup has been a package that pays you back when you sell to other investors
who in turn hope to sell it to other investors by a mechanism known as funding, in inverted commas. That's what Nassim Taleb says. And in my experience, it's very similar to that. And then if you go to YouTube after this or when you're listening, and Google Chamath, Chamath, and then the Ponzi scheme video, I think he sort of illustrates exactly how that works. But importantly, and I think relevant to this discussion, is that he explains this a concept of growth, in inverted commas, and how the investors will want this startup to grow at all costs, so that they can prove that this startup has potential, and then that gives them leverage in future negotiations and investment, you know, rounds and raises, and so on and so forth. So the long segue to the one thing that I want you to answer is that there is this narrative in tech in Silicon Valley that you should grow at all costs, this blitz scaling thing that was introduced, grow, don't worry about monetizing it straight away, even if you have to take a loss and fund it with debt for a number of years. It's all about gaining as much adoption as we can, and then we can worry about that sort of profit and, you know, monetization thing a bit later. And that has been the dominant, I would say, orthodox way of the startup SaaS world for a long time now, and that has been funded by debt. And now it's 2023, in case anyone's listening, and the debt markets have changed their tune, and the interest rate, I think, was just gone up another 25 basis points today in the US. So it's hovering around 4 point something. Don't quote me on that. So now these investors are having to pay a lot more to gain funding. And a lot of funds are there, but they're being very cautious about who they're investing in. And the name of the game right now is unit economics and positive unit economics. So it's been this weird reversal. But I'm interested to ask you, you know, which one is better? Should we pursue growth first or profit? What does your research say?
There are different games, right? So are we talking about creating a sound business that generates profits from its product market so that it can sustain itself and expand and so forth? Or are we entirely in the game of finding the greater fool, right? So someone who's going to pay for this still unproven but perceived or portrayed as promising thing. Right? If we're talking about creating real businesses that eventually will be successful as businesses, that they will reach a point where they have sustained viability and they have paid back all the costs it took to create them and then continue to operate. There, I would say, it is quite clear. And this was the study we published back in 2009, right? When we had large data sets from Australia and from Sweden. So thousands of businesses. We looked at profitable growth is, everyone would agree, that is a sound place to be, right? So we say, okay, how do you get there? Do you get there by first becoming profitable at a modest scale, and then you expand this thing that has proven profitable? Or do you go for growth, and as a result of your growth, you also become profitable? And there is quite a lot of theory that suggests that the latter would be. I mean, we were talking about first mover advantages, yes, or at least we did back in the 90s.
Well, pricing penetration is like a classic strategy, right? Like you go in low, you capture the market, so then you can raise the price slowly.
Scale economies, experience effects, and you have the networks effects as well, which unfortunately applies to very small minority of businesses. So what we showed in that result was that overall, in both countries, in all industries, in all size classes, I think we had somewhat shaky results in retailing or something like that, but otherwise it was very clear, you're much more likely to end up in the star category, above average growth and above average profit at the same time, if you start with above average profit.
Yes.
Right. So profit first. Moreover, if you do go for high growth from a weak profit basis, you're much more likely to transition to the worst corner, namely low profit and low growth in the next period. So it means normally businesses don't become profitable as a result of their growth, and they can't sustain the growth either because it is expensive to grow, right? On other people's money. And if you don't have a superior product to offer the market, then you won't have any margins. You will have to buy customers by undercutting price and so forth. And that is not sustainable. And next time around, the external investors that you need will not be impressive because you haven't shown profitability. So their patience will run out. And that what happens, though, you slump into the living dead category.
I just want to pull you up. What does more likely mean in this case? Like, is there a factor? Obviously, there's like averages between these different sectors, but...
In most analysis, 2 to 3 times in both directions, right? So they're 2 to 3 times more likely to go to the star category, 2 to 3 times more likely to go to the what we call the poor category, the loser category. And this is, in social science research, a very strong effect.
I mean, that's the complete opposite of what a lot of these companies are peddling. Like, let's just take, for example, what's an unprofitable company, the tech company now that you can think of? I know Snapchat's having problems right now and getting corrected. Again, it's a social media network, which is a network effect sort of type company. I know Uber has tried...
Uber is still in the...
They're way below what even the IPO was. Again, public markets can distort that, but I mean, they're struggling. I think Airbnb is doing okay, but I wouldn't say any of them are like wildly profitable right now. And there's a lot that are...
Amazon probably is.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually.
And this is sort of the one example that is pointed to, right? They were unprofitable for a long, long time, and then they become profitable.
But I don't think they were unprofitable on purpose. They took their profits and reinvested them so they could claim like negative tax credits or something. But I think they reinvested all their profit back into the business. Yeah.
But they're one of the reasons why people believe in this model, right? But this is based on the most unusual example you could,
like an edge case,
you could find, right?
So, yes.
By and large, no, it doesn't happen. I should say what we show directly in the research and in replication research is how they move over time. We don't really go deep into the reasons for this, why it is. But I would say it is not sort of the profit as such that it is what that represents, right? And what it represents is probably either of two things or both of them. You have developed a strong enough concept, so a strong enough offering to the market that is valued by enough people more highly than it costs to produce it, right? This is really business 101, right?
Business it's like product, 101. Business model validation 101. Like, do you have something people want? Are they willing to pay for it? Can you produce it for less money than people are willing to pay for it? It's like, if yes, then you've got a good business model.
And is there enough of those who want to pay at that level, right? The other thing is a sound culture in the business. And I saw signs of this as early as in the 80s. There were studies in Sweden of the startups from a university, a tech university there, right? And VC backing, when VC was relatively new then, right? So venture capital infusion. And this was just case-based. It was quite anecdotal. But those that made it were not those that took in a lot of external money. Those that made it were those that did anything to bring in an income stream. I mean, it could be unrelated to the main product. I mean, they would be consulting and working nighttime to make it possible, right? But it establishes a sound culture that in the end, money needs to come from the market, costs need to be kept reasonably low, and you need to be careful with it. When you have this impetus to grow very rapidly, you do it on external money, and so you don't get enough care in developing the offering, you don't get enough care in developing the optimal way of getting this offering to the market, and you don't get the right mentality. When the money is burnt, we go back to the same source of money again, right? until
it sort of reminds me of this analogy, right? Like it's like fitness training. You're trying to get fit, but one's in low gravity environment, one's in a high gravity environment, and you know that force, the high gravity, forces you to get a lot fitter faster and stay fit rather than the low one. Yeah, okay. So culturally conditions the organization and focuses them on something that will sort of be a guiding star for the future. And I get it. But just one thing you said earlier, and this came up in an earlier talk you did, was around the growth companies. Sometimes they can get focused on buying a customer instead of like earning a customer. Can you give me some really good examples of this? Because this is something that I come across personally a lot, which is some startups like to use arbitrage advertising sort of plays to harvest demand and buy customers bidding in an environment with their competitors to try and get them at X unit cost without really understanding whether they're a good customer in the first place and, you know, where they're positioned. And there's a lot of trade-offs with that. So I've seen this firsthand, but over to you. I mean, what is this concept of buying customers and why is it bad?
You're probably better than me to come up with the examples, right? But I mean, there are two things. One is a simple undercutting. You sell whatever it is, or you give it away for free to begin with, right? So to get the users and so forth, and not knowing how is this going to create an income stream, because relatively few businesses have this potential for massive advertising income, which has been for Facebook, for example, right? That is an unusual situation that you will have, and Google, right? So they, again, very, very unusual big examples that mislead expectations and behavior. I think Uber is an example we're talking about. I've seen that because it was a gift to us that Uber came. I mean, in Australia, I had the regulated taxi industry that didn't adopt any technology when they should and so forth. And when I lived on the Gold Coast, if it was a Friday night, you could call them and they would take your business and maybe they would turn up. They wouldn't even give you a time estimate.
Oh, the taxis, man. Yeah, it was terrible. And then Uber came and I remember it was really cheap for me because I got into it when I was overseas and it wasn't even available back in Australia, but I was using it because there's a small cohort. It was very underground. And I remember the prices were so cheap and like they didn't care about where you went or the distance or whatever. So you get around really cheaply. And then I was talking to the drivers and I remember I asked them how much they got paid. And it was all I would call local Australians, as in maybe they'd been there for a long time and, you know, a bit older or whatever. And they were getting paid like $45, $50 an hour, even more. Like it was really, really attractive. Good money, and they were getting paid by PayPal and they didn't have to declare it as income, so they kept it in their wallets. The point is there was a disparity between how much I was paying, how much they were getting for that effort. I know Uber was subsidizing heavily that, especially at the start, and I noticed over the years maybe the drivers are getting paid less and less and the fares for us as the passengers are going way higher. Classic pricing penetration.
Exactly. And it becomes less attractive for the customer and it becomes less attractive for those workers. So they're going to retain those that have fewest alternatives, right? So they're going to get worse drivers and fewer customers. I used to regularly use Uber, but more lately it is, I mean, often more expensive,
the irony is,
longer
wait. It's becoming what taxis used to be. And now I think using the taxi apps is probably a better option, to be honest. That's the irony in this whole thing. So what did
I guess that's what we call market clearance.
So what exactly did they disrupt? I don't know. And
no, but I mean, it did something good. Yeah. I mean, you could say it has been subsidizing travel for us. And when that comes from the private sector, that's better than it is the taxpayers' money, so that subsidizes at least sometimes.
Okay, well, coming back to your point, though, around maybe I can add to this discussion, but in my experience, there is extreme heterogeneity in customer acquisition. And when you look at averages, it doesn't look at how good a customer that customer is. So example, I could sell the cheapest product at cheapest price and acquire that customer for quite cheaply at scale using some sort of ad platform and have a formula for that. But I'm going to get really bad flighty customers who are going to leave me, not renew, not really have any loyalty to me or sort of any liking. It's just going to be, oh, whatever. Yeah, I use that company. It's cheap. I got the thing. And then they'll go somewhere else. And you have a lot of these trade-offs between acquiring customers that you can transact with really quickly. And then maybe some customers that are a bit higher friction, a bit more expensive to acquire, but in the long run will be way better customers, refer other people to you, and you get this sort of growth effect from those. And what I see a lot is a lack of understanding about the quality of the customer that you're acquiring and how long that may take and how much friction that may take and expertise and resources that goes into that. And I see this all the time, and everyone just lumps it into like, customer, get me a customer. And then there are certain laws and mathematical averages that sort of come into play there, which are very interesting. Tell me more about this study, because you had some SMEs, and can I just ask, like, what kind of SMEs were they? Before we go into like the replicability of it, I mean, it was 3,500 Aussie and 2,500 Swedish SMEs, but what size, what sector?
I mean, these were SMEs of any age. We had the young ones, the smallest, not the tiniest ones, I think, if I remember correctly, but quite small ones up to sort of what we call medium size, right? And the larger they get, the fewer you have, right? So you can't have very fine categories there. But the patents held up everywhere, so with the younger and the older and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't much. One shortcoming was that we didn't have a very long period. So we had 2 or 3 years, and you could say that, yeah, okay, but if you do this, you invest in growth in order for it to come. Sure. Maybe it takes longer, right? So that I would say would be the biggest weakness. Plus that the data was sort of getting oldish already then. So these were things that people could object and say that that it's not like current realities. Very quickly, and of course, those that think that entrepreneurship is only this sort of high potential category, they will say, well, this is true for regular small businesses, but it's not what we're talking about. But relatively quickly, we got a replication in Finnish biotech. So these are tech-oriented, ambitious, very often externally funded.
Very high risk too, biotech.
And the results were exactly the same. Sometimes stronger.
Wow.
In that research, right? So that increased the confidence. But now, just recently, there was this massive replication across 28 countries in Europe, across all industries and size classes and so forth, and separately in every country, in every industry, with different kinds of in different size classes, right, different age classes, using exactly the methods we used and using slightly different ways of measuring growth and measuring profitability and different techniques for doing the analysis. I have never in my career seen anything in social science that have had so consistent results in analysis after analysis and after analysis. So in most cases, I mean, there's some variance in the strength of the effect, but across most of the analysis, 2 to 3 times more likely to go from high profit to high growth to high profit than from high growth to high profit combined with high growth, right? And the same, much more likely for those that start from high growth at low profit to end up in the next period low in both. And now it was period up to 7 years. So that's quite it's time for those who still believe in growth first to show us their compelling systematic evidence for that. I'd say that some things are different in the digital world, mm-hmm. for sure. You can grow much faster with digital offerings and so forth, mm-hmm. right? But it doesn't change the profit issue.
Okay.
You can grow, but the other pieces need to be in place. There must be enough people who want this and want it enough to pay what it takes. Or some, I mean, it may not be a user pay business model, but there may be some kind of revenue that covers this, right? So you also had some quote there for some sort of growing loss-making businesses is easy. It doesn't take any skills and so forth. Right? I take the example. Well, if maximum growth is all you need, well, buy gold then. Buy gold ingots and sell them at half market price. You will have fantastic growth, right?
Well, that was the point that Kara Swisher was making on this. I think she was commenting. I can't remember. It was like an interview. I think it was MSNBC, which is a bit left-leaning. But anyway, she was on there getting interviewed. I think it's a tech company of some sort that had high growth potential. And she was like, well, you know, growing at a loss isn't hard. That isn't taking any skill. Anyone can do that. And it's true. Some of the companies I do, I'm like, I'm going to acquire customers. Like sometimes they struggle with acquiring customers. I'm like, well, I can do it. It's just like, it's a matter of how much that costs and whether you get any payback from that in the long term. Sometimes there's a bit of a lag effect if, you know, it's a monthly billing thing over a long sort of number of months or years. But you do need to do those unit economics and make that decision. So, and it's very funny when I've done that. Sometimes the way that we're spending the money to acquire the customers is very different to how they probably should be spending it. So they tend to go with the easiest path of resistance to get the customer at the cheapest cost versus maybe some employing a salesperson, you know, doing some prospecting, one-on-one phone calls, events, face-to-face things that are maybe more expensive and not as scalable. But when you crunch the numbers, are way better for the company short and long term. So it's this funny trade-off that happens.
There's a lot of unsound stuff going on, right? And maybe in some cases it is deliberately in a game of finding the greater fool, right? But in many other cases they really believe that this is going to be a profitable business.
I mean, I deal with a lot of finance people. I mean, how do I put this politely? Founders sometimes aren't aware that they're being played. And the person pulling the strings are the people financing the company, and they're there to pump the value or perceived value of the company up and then hand it off to somebody else or sell it or exit or somehow, you know, earn their multiple before the going gets tough. And that's sort of the ultimate finance player, really, is being very hands-off, wheeling and dealing, and then exit with a nice profit. They don't actually really care about growing the company. They care about growing the perceived value of the company at all times. So I think there's this strange dynamic sometimes between the people operating the business and people funding the business, which is a tension that doesn't really
now stop. We should say here that you have the whole range from very serious investors, which have a very important function, right? To
the soft banks of the world.
Why the culture has developed. So the big middle there has been lured and pushed in this unsound direction, right? Of promoting maximum growth. I think it's tragic because I think there are many examples of startups that could have become quite sound businesses at a more modest size, but a healthy size, right? But they were never geared towards that. So they developed systems and stuff as if they were heading for world domination, right? And even if they have very little sort of extra cost for you to build up this apparatus that is completely unrealistic in markets which actually are competitive, there's little hope that you actually will get and keep this dominant position and at the same time have margins, right? So if there is this size of a market and 10 businesses decide that they will aim for taking all of it, right? They will all be very suboptimally developed and invest way too much and in the rush, of course. We know that time compression diseconomies, it becomes more expensive and you get lower quality if you try to do things very, very fast. Right? There isn't always a rush.
No, so there's this funny book called Blitzscaling with a Z that was authored by Reid Hoffman, which really precipitated this growth at all costs, scale at all costs, as big as possible mantra. That sort of that strategy really floated throughout Silicon Valley. And that sort of like is in contrast to this very interesting, very early video of Jeff Bezos from Amazon, who was asked about, you know, what is a brand and what is Amazon? And he said, look, you know, there's just things that take time and a trust is gained slowly, repeatedly over time where you deliver what you say you're going to deliver. And there's no quick way around these things. It just takes years of doing it day in, day out. And eventually, you know, the nonlinear sort of growth curve kicks in and you get to this inflection point where your brand becomes of certain size that it does start to grow and morph and, you know, capture the category. And he's like, yeah, there's just You can't rush that. It doesn't matter. Whereas the blitzscaling mantra is like, you know, acquire adoption at all costs, you know, fund with debt, you know, go crazy on all these channels and double down and, you know, worry about that later. So I just find it that I meet firms and people within one camp or the other, and generally it's in the blitzscaling camp, I'll have to say.
Well, Amazon, they played it smart also, that sort of they did this massive puppy dog ploy, right, that they were a bookstore. And then when the global financial crisis hit, they sort of probably did what they always intended to become a general retailer and started an acquisition strategy, because others were in dire straits, so that you can make cheap acquisitions and so forth. So there you see a business that actually adapts to external realities and uses that to strategic advantage, right?
Yeah, and it was a very smart play. And they also, AWS, the servers, was that actually an internal project that they needed. They were paying too much money for, I think it was Oracle servers or something at the time, or some other company, and they couldn't do what they wanted to do on this project to expand. And then, so they basically created their own data center. And then it was so good that other companies, like, word spread within the community, and then other companies actually wanted to that for themselves, so they went, okay, well, we'll just sell this. And then it ends up becoming this huge cash cow for them, that is, you know, still to this day quite lucrative. So very interesting. Yeah, again, that entrepreneurial sort of
that's also an interesting phenomenon that happens in a smaller scale with many startups, right, that they
and now we talk pivot, about right?
slightly more real businesses. something that is a peripheral part of the original concept is what takes off, and then they have the ability to see this and tune into that, right? MailChimp is an example like that as well. Another one that was helped by a crisis, right? So MailChimp, that wasn't their main business at all, but it became it when there was a sort of a big need for that kind of service.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. I was watching another one of your videos, just to quote it, and it's really interesting. You said about the dangers of growth firms having to rely on buying customers, which we kind of just mentioned, right? And they're having to compensate for a lack of strong market advantage, and this incurs higher marketing costs. Tell me more about what you mean by strong market advantage. Are they buying the wrong customers or unprofitable customers? And what are the reasons behind this?
Mostly it is about, well, either having a superior offering or having a superior way of keeping costs down so you can offer more for less, and you can do that sustainably, right?
So it could be a process or some sort of, if they're manufacturing something, technique or a system, or so some kind of competitive advantage, basically.
I mean, either you really need to be better at something, right? Or you need to get to where Microsoft was with sort of such dominance that they can force their stuff on us whether we like it or not, right? But then again, you end up with those extremely unusual examples that will not apply to 99.90-something% of all businesses.
Yeah, the edge cases, yeah. Okay. So you mentioned this before about the reason why these firms who seek profit earlier tend to do better. Can you expand on that? Like, what are the main things that they do better?
These are things that I haven't, in my own research, looked deeply into, right? So then it becomes more speculative. So as with my research hat on, I can speak with a lot of confidence about the broad patterns that sort of, yes, it is 2 to 3 times more likely that they come from high profit to the star category, and it is two and so forth. Then it is mostly interpretation, and it is images from other research, right? But it is not a systematic accumulation of the evidence on my part, but I said it. But I think there's a lot of logic to it, that either you develop a better market offering, so you offer more for the same money, or you offer the same for less money, right? And you do that sustainably. Relatedly, you're just better at running your business.
See, so one thing I didn't mention before is, you know, the way this funding game goes is that if the startup or the early business that's being funded perhaps by external investors, if they become profitable, they don't need further investment because they can reinvest the profits into growth. So it gives the internal operators or the founders or, you know, people running the business more leverage in negotiations down the track, or they can cut out their investors. And this is where this very interesting dynamic comes along between investors and the executives or owners of the business that is very interesting, which is why I think sometimes this other narrative around growth is somewhat peddled. Yeah, there's a lot of politics that goes on. So have you encountered any of that, by the way, or you probably don't get down to that level?
Well, I'll get into another of your questions which relates to this, and that is how the phenomenon of entrepreneurship and how it is perceived has changed over time. And I would say when I started in the late 80s, at least the mental image of entrepreneurship, I think it was two mental images, but one was sort of this, that single male, well, not necessarily, but sole male, starts a manufacturing operation and then slowly grows it and runs it until their retirement, when they either sell it or hand it over to their children, right? And we can get back to the other mental image as well. That, of course, has changed over time, right? And that there's something good with that. And sort of it's not just we don't just think manufacturing. Maybe that is the last thing we think about. There's a broader view of what kinds of businesses. There is more diverse view of who is an entrepreneur, and we have realized that it is not centered around a single person. It's often better to be a team, and there's a lot of people beyond the team that contribute. And you don't have to have this lifelong relationship to a single business. You can go in and out of different entrepreneurial projects, and there's something good and sound of that, right? But that trend has sort of gone too far in this, that it is rushing something to some kind of scale, and it's just about quickly make money out of it and so forth, and there's sort of the positive side of it, yeah, you get a bit of entrepreneurship training here, you get a bit of entrepreneurship training there. Preferably, you should start to do little business things in your teens. That's your more formative years, and so forth, right? But and that may make you a better entrepreneur over time. And when you're somewhere in between 35 and 45, you may start that fantastic business, right? That really makes a big mark. Which you may not have done if you had sort of started this one business and then lived with that. But when that trend goes too far, it is sort of just a game of creating images of businesses that you can sell to the greater fool and then move on.
Okay, well, I think you're sort of hinting at something I really want your take on, which is, okay, so we've done this research. We kind of know that you should seek profit early on. There's maybe some inferences you can make about the culture within it or the focus of organization being self-fulfilling in that way. Obviously, there's a lot of complexity around, you know, trying to replicate that. But let's just say you were giving advice, because I know you are... What's your official position? You're on the board of a couple of things. You work with Canberra and the Queensland Entrepreneur Organization, and you work with the federal government as well, correct?
Oh, I did a few years ago. We had a big project that they had a lot of interest in and co-founded.
Okay, well, if you're giving advice to entrepreneurs or an accelerator or something, pretend you're acting in an advisor position. I mean, are there some pointers or general guidance you can give them based on your knowledge?
Yeah, I can, but I should say I'm not that much involved directly with businesses. Sure. My advisory role has been more at the policy level than at the level of individual businesses. But practitioners usually tend to think I make more sense than most other academics they meet. So I think I have some ability to see into the world. And from start, when I started to do research, right? So when I saw this, on the one hand, you had all those theories that expected the willingness to grow, that was taken for granted. And I mean, you don't need to know that many small business people to see that they may like some of the consequences of growth, and there are others that they may find a bit daunting, right? So many traditional great success businesses have started from relatively modest beginnings, right? You couldn't tell at an early stage that this is going to be a global phenomenon. Now, IKEA started as a teenager selling something from the parents' home and mail order, right? And they may not have that ambition, they may not have those goals, but then they do stuff and they do it well, they've got positive feedback, they make money, they get the resources, they get the confidence, and you say, maybe that is a better way of getting there than sort of, you're 20-something, right? And you're supposed to lead the development of this thing aiming for global. I think at alone in the bed at night, they feel that, oh, what am I into?
Yeah, it can be pretty lonely. Just to add one thing, because I know we mentioned this when we were talking the other week around social ties, because this is really interesting. Obviously, some of the work that I do is around advisory boards, which is arguably a weak social tie without a vested interest in their business. So you're acting in their interest, but you don't have any sort of carry, or you don't advantage yourself from anything that they decide to do, which is very different to perhaps consulting or unstructured advisory or mentorship and things like that. So can you just elaborate what you mean by the power of weak social ties? I know you referenced a study around this and how perhaps entrepreneurs can sort of create a structure of these weak social ties to point them in the right direction.
Yeah. The bigger issue here is there's one of the main things I learned from when I started, and which has been reinforced in a lot of ways, is that successful entrepreneurs don't do it all themselves or rely just on themselves. They identify, they cultivate, and they use other people's talents. If you don't do that, you are going to level off somewhere, right? So, and then specifically the weak ties. This is a big thing from sociology, that the importance of weak ties. That means to get input from people who have different kind of knowledge than you, different kind of experiences, right? Because when we're a little group of people who we have the same political views, we have the same kind of education, blah, 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 you have this little bubble, right? And then you think the world is like that, right? And that's when you really need other people's input, other people's views, who live in a different kind of area, have a different kind of education, different social circles. So what they occupy their minds with and their social interactions about is completely different.
But isn't it funny how naturally sometimes, and especially if some people are seeking comfort or insecure, they seek out people that are similar to them. They do the complete opposite of that, which is effective. They see people who think them, like the same things as them, and then you get sort of reference bubble happening. Sometimes getting diversity of thought requires someone to be quite open-minded and willing to be confronted and said that, you know, you're wrong, which I don't know, it takes a certain character of person to be able to do that, I find.
Yeah, and you have philosophers like John Stuart Mill, for example, who said that one who only knows their own side of a thing doesn't know much about that at all. and I think that they had sort of a higher education ideal in Britain, and I think they still do in some places, that you're forced to argue the opponent's point, right? You train this again and again.
I think it came from some African culture, I think, that dynamic. It's like you, when you have an argument, you must repeat back the opposition's argument so that you know, the other person knows that you understand their argument. Mm. And in doing so, it actually, you get a better outcome.
But I think we should have more of role play in education and all that, and where you're also forced to sort of do really well in arguing things you don't believe in. So I think it is eye-opening, and higher education should be mind-expanding and eye-opening more than it is now. I think we've lost something when higher education has become a mass phenomenon, and it is seniorer high school rather than what it once was, right? So or what we believe it was.
Yeah, I remember doing debating in like high school, and you know, I had to take the side of, you know, for or against, and it was against my actual own personal views, and I found it really hard because, you know, the passion isn't there, and you need to debate and get your point across, but also get the crowd on your side about something you staunchly don't believe in underneath. It's actually quite hard. So yeah, no, but I like it. I mean, you know, just turning into business. I mean, every meeting I have, you know, I'm inserted in there, and sometimes there's a group of people and there's a lot of discussion, and there's a lot of people who don't agree with things. And I find, you know, asking why they have that opinion and then sort of pulling that apart and, you know, removing some assumptions, and, you know, you can make completely different decisions after the end of the meeting than you would have had otherwise just using group things. So interesting.
Well, I've come across time and again that great entrepreneurs, I don't know if they have sort of learned this somewhere or if they have sort of intuitively reinvented this insight that they need to have input from far away from their circumstances, right?
I think it's definitely like an open-mindedness. It's like what we call a growth mindset. I'm not sure if you've read that famous book by Carol Dweck around, you know, open-mindedness and that sort of like that path. But anyway, I just wanted to get for you quickly, and I know you may have covered this in this discussion already, but are there any sort of widely held beliefs around entrepreneurship or cliches that you know to be wrong and you want to correct them now, like things that people always believe that you're like, well, actually that's not the case?
There's sort of this great person theory of entrepreneurship, right? That exaggerated belief that it is about a person and that it is a single person that is 75% or more of the explanation for a success story, right? If you look at serial entrepreneurs, right, their different projects have wildly different outcomes. So it can't just be about the person, right? So, and part of that is also this idea that people are born entrepreneurs, right? You can't train. You need to be born an entrepreneur. Now, of course, genetics are strong and people are born with less or more or less potential for things. But what do we mean when we mean someone is born an entrepreneur? Take little baby Steve Jobs and we take little baby Elon Musk here, for example. Then we take them at birth, right? And we put them with nurses into a dark room and we feed them and we give them no other stimulation and we keep them alive. And then we let them out at age 20. I don't think it would, if they survive this treatment, I don't think they would start any companies, right? So what do we really mean, right? when we say, of course they have learned things, right? If over time that they have taken on board, if it has been formal entrepreneurship schooling, or if it has been experience based, or it has been other types of, I mean, entrepreneurship, you can benefit a lot from the persuasion principles of social psychology, for example, and you can certainly benefit a lot from superior technological knowledge in some areas and so forth. So everything can be trained. Mozart wouldn't have become the genius composer without having the right genes, but he wouldn't have become it without the kind of training he got either from very young age, right? So
no, I love it. So be very careful when you're trying to replicate someone else's success, like survivorship bias, like by buying a popular book about Elon Musk and be like him and think you're going to do it. So
and we know that there's I think Steve Jobs in particular, I say, well, the world wouldn't have been quite, you can't say that it was all in the technology that was available. Development would have been the same anyway. I think he personally and the people, he genius like Johnny Ive, created something that we might not have seen, or it would have taken much longer to get there without them, right? But they were also in the right place in the right time,
exactly.
Right? Steve Jobs got adopted into growing up in Silicon Valley. So without that, we wouldn't have heard of him. And likewise with Bill Gates, right? He was just at the right time, and in his teen years, he had some access to get an outlet for his computing interest, his programming interest that 99% plus of all kids at that time wouldn't have.
Oh, and his mother hooked him up with their first customer, which is an enterprise customer, IBM, I think. Yeah. So nice little leg up to start.
Yeah. But then he must have had something special as well, because he actually did this teenager startup thing, and then he became a somewhat a very effective CEO of a rather large corporation later on. And few people can take all those roles. So they, of course, there's something special with them, but it's a combination of things. And more important, I think, how people should think about this is that, I mean, you don't need to be Musk, you don't need to be Steve Jobs. You can be one effective part of a successful entrepreneurial team.
Yes.
And also, when you get involved in this project that you're really passionate about, I mean, this is something you really care about, and you're a little introvert, but now this is so important that you overcome this introversion, right? And so your martial abilities that don't come natural to you, but that in that context you have. So most people can be effective parts of entrepreneurial teams under the right circumstances and with the right people.
Okay,
around.
Great. Well, do you think your research will stand the test of time? Like, what's changed since you began researching this field and in your initial start of your career to now, and where do you see it going?
Well, you could say the phenomenon of entrepreneurship is partly the same and partly very different, right? When you have sort of, you have tech platforms that allow new types of economic activities, mm-hmm. and those people who make money in various ways via YouTube and so forth, are they entrepreneurs? Yeah, why not? I mean, yeah. And the exact expressions change over time. Maybe we should get back to this when we'll talk about the book I've read.
Yes, definitely. But I mean, at the same time, do you think these principles that you've discovered around profitability and growth and that dynamic will still apply in the future?
I think that stands. The proportion of new business that really are in such a situation that it is sort of a winner-take-all market, you really need to be firstest with the mostest, yeah. like Drucker. That is so unusual. It's not non-existent, but it is so unusual. Mm. In most markets, you have a more normal situation. You don't have an outlook into more or less a monopoly or oligopoly where there's only room for a few and where you can have absolutely massive advertising income and so forth. It's just so unusual. The vast majority of businesses, there needs to be a sound business and that is business administration 101. Right? So revenue bigger than cost. Yeah,
exactly. Great. Okay. Well, hey, that was a really interesting conversation, Per. I think I got a lot of out of that as well. And I've been going back through some of your papers and the other replicable studies that have confirmed your initial study on this, just to make sure that it wasn't a red herring. Mm-hmm. And they were really interesting. So, yeah, and just on that, I mean, are there any other books that you've read or reading right now that have changed your mind? Doesn't have to be 100% related to this, that you'd recommend other people read?
The most recent entrepreneurship book I read over Christmas here is a book by a professor at Princeton, Derek Lido. But he's a very unusual professor because he's also a successful entrepreneur, and he has a very broad take on this phenomenon. So he's interested in ethnography and so forth. So very deep studies. So his book, which I think this is a good book for academics because it's not a usual research book, right? It's very unique. And it's also a book for reflective practitioners, I would say. So the book is called The Entrepreneurs, The Relentless Quest for Value. And it's related to the question you just asked me about the phenomenon of entrepreneurship. He tries to get to the heart of entrepreneurship, the things that always, the foundation of entrepreneurship that stays the same in a sense. Right? So he goes back in history and even prehistory. It's fascinating stuff. But he connects it all the way back to present day as well, right? About the in this book. So I think it is a very interesting read to reflect on. And it is for a researcher, for an entrepreneurship researcher, is different from what you normally read. And for a reflective practitioner, it is a broad take on it. So I think that's
yeah, quite interesting. Definitely. I mean, and talking about that, I mean, I had a quote, you know, it was a tweet that I read out from Nassim Taleb. Do you have a particular quote or meme or something, a quip that, you know, is quite poignant for this topic or makes you laugh or is just sort of true that you'd like to share with people?
I'm not a meme guy, you know, but Kara Swisher, anyone can grow it. A competent loss, it isn't hard, it takes no skill. I thought that resonates with me. It's a bit tragic that it needs to be said, right?
No, that's great. Okay, perfect. And over to you now. It's all about you. What do you want to get the word out about today?
You know, I have this idea. I had this idea for a book I would write, or different versions for different audiences, and a movement I would like to start, and it probably won't happen, right? But it's just write business. So write business is to subscribe to a set of principles of how you run a business, and this should be taught as part of business education. Ethics and stuff like that should not be sort of an add-on, right? This should be about deeply ingrained principles of how you want to run a business. And of course, it may not be realistic to fully reach all those ideals all the time, right? But it is. I mean, you want to sell stuff that you really believe in, right? You want to delight customers and offer them more value than they pay. You don't want to trick customers into buying and you keep them paying because it's difficult to end the subscription and things like that. All those ridiculous things, right? You don't really want to. You would prefer to sell a printer and make people to pay what it costs to actually make a good printer of that. And then you don't want them. You wouldn't want to have as a business to sell ink or cartridges, and have software that forces you to change it when not even half has been used, or fill them a little less, right? All those ridiculous things that are done and sometimes supported by the patent system.
Okay,
right?
Well, I have something for you then. I'll plug another company that I know sounds like what you're getting at here, which is B Corporations. I know there's some in Australia, New Zealand that the movement is quite big, but you know, it goes around governance, environmental impact, community, customers and workers. And it just applies another layer above and beyond, you know, the legal limits and instills a lot of these things. So you can get B Corp certification if you meet these certain criteria. Mm. So
if you internalize this as a value, then you don't take that cheap short-term solution that maybe isn't the best. You force
buying customers and trying to get growth figures.
you force yourself to come up with something better, right? You need to innovate in some regard in order to solve it the right way. The other idea or sort of related idea, I think it's something which time has come. I dreamt of planting this with the heirs of IKEA so they could do their own thing, right? So there should be this business, brick and mortar and online. It's called Kvalitet, Swedish spelling, with KV. And this is a place where you can reliably get, in any product category, good functional and aesthetic quality. You don't have to pay for a lot of branding and advertising. So everything available is quality. It's durable. It's not made to fail in a few years and so forth. Oh, tough luck. You can't have as much reselling then. You know, it's not driven by those ideals. Then they should be lasting.
Okay, I like it.
And returns, of course, no questions asked. You I think it is. I mean, it may not never win the mass market. If 80% of people are such that they will go for the cheap crap that is less painful for the wallet here and now, that, well, that's not our market, right? But more and more people, and it is in line with the. There is more people now who are comfortable enough that they can pay for quality, and they will. And there is the other big trend is that doing what is right for the planet. So even people who don't have great means, maybe they have fewer things, but they want to go for those quality durable things, repairable and so forth, right? But because there we have gone completely in the other direction, right? Make it hard to fix it, so they have to.
And speaking of that, at the same time, maybe some tech startups with quality services instead of low quality. Maybe it's still the same sort of principles there. But thanks, Per. I think that was a really good discussion. I hope it gives some people who are maybe currently founders, entrepreneurs, some better guidance around strategy and what to focus on. And if they want to become successful, maybe some pointers of things to avoid that we know to give them a lower chance of success. So I want to thank you for your time. And if people want to reach out to you, is there a preferred method?
I might regret this, you know, but my email is easy to find online. And email is the means of communication that I'm most reliable with.
Okay, great. So on the QT website, that is fine. Look, the people that listen to this are all high quality people, so you don't have to worry about that. And the numbers aren't huge, not in the thousands just yet, so I don't think it'll be inundated. But great, thanks for your time, Per. And yeah, I encourage everyone who's listening to read that study that caught my eye, and maybe some of the future ones, just to hammer the point home. So thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, there's a sketchbook video as well.
There is, yes. I watched that one on
about
YouTube.
The growth of
yes,
profit.
Yes, yeah, the quadrants is really good because I think, you know, we can't visualize this right now, but I'll put it on the video. But yeah, the quadrant and sort of some of the things you describe about moving left and right and up and down, I think that sort of really hit the point home for me. So it sort of reminded me of that, you know, those sort of BCG matrix, cash cows and things like that, and product portfolio management. But thanks again.
Okay. Well, thank you. I've much enjoyed it.
That was great hearing from an empirical perspective some of the macro forces which affect growing businesses. And I'd recommend this episode with another one. The episode with Sean Ellis back in season 2, episode 10, where we talk about what growth actually is in the tech world and what it isn't. Because there's a lot of confusion and misinterpretation in this area. If you found any of this useful, share it on social and tell your colleagues about it. I really appreciate it. In fact, message me and tell me what you thought about it too via LinkedIn or Twitter. I'm ramping up the reverse newsletter where I send you an email each month and answer your questions instead of just dumping information onto you and clogging your inbox. Sound good? Go to hybrancy.substack.com to sign up. Press the bell alert icon to receive notifications next time I drop a podcast episode so you don't miss it. I drop one of these roughly every 7 to 10 days. You can also sample episodes and watch highlights via video via the Hybrancy YouTube channel, which is all neatly categorized via the playlist function. But that's all for now. See you next time, and thanks for listening.